Welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men in the middle of the country get together and talk about politics, current events, and other fun stuff. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
Well, Brandon, there's really only one topic to talk about, the assassination attempt on Trump. That was Saturday. We talked about warming up. I was at a wedding reception, and suddenly everybody's phone lit up, and word got around pretty fast. Where were you at when you heard this, and what was your reaction to it?
I had just returned home because I had had drinks with a friend catching up, and she had sent me a text saying, "Oh, did you hear, you know, turn on the news?" And I just received a New York Times email notification breaking news about the shooting. So literally had just walked in the door when I heard and started tuning in and trying to figure out what had happened. Yeah. I think all of us were trying to figure out, like, what happened, what's the extent, who's injured, what's going on. It was surreal. It was very surreal because most of us in our lifetime have never witnessed an attempt. Other than those that are older now who were around during the Reagan assassination attempt.
I remember that, Brandon.
Which I actually, to detour for just a second, so one of the surgeons that operated on Reagan actually lives here in Kansas City, by the way, who saved his life. He's in his 90s now.
Okay.
So just kind of interesting story, but yeah.
But I mean, I didn't think Trump got hit. First, I thought it was some sort of fragment or something that hit him. I heard a piece of glass from the podium or something
that
hit him. But it does appear like he did actually get grazed by a bullet, and he got extremely lucky that he didn't get the back of his head.
He was extremely fortunate because he had turned his head at that moment to read from a teleprompter. And
those damn illegal immigrants in that chart saved Trump's life.
Yeah.
Let's take this first. This isn't like other shootings of presidents. I was alive when Reagan was shot. I was in middle school. The social media aspects of this are going to be fascinating. And the social media conspiracy
theories are always running wild.
It's never going to go away. And the fact that you can rewatch this over and over again in high def video is going to mean this incident, this shooting, this assassination attempt, I think is going to resonate a little bit differently and is going to have longer legs and is going to have more of an impact maybe than something outside of the social media era.
I think you're right. I also think that, I don't know, I think we may live in a day and age where people, at least substantial segments of society, will never accept the possibility that an assassination attempt on a president may not be partisan in nature or may not be overtly political. If you go back through the history of attempted assassinations on presidents, not all of them were political. Not all of them were a member of the other party upset with a policy trying to strike out. Many times it's been people that are just mentally unstable, that are doing it for weird reasons, random reasons, attention reasons, not necessarily, you know, as a response to something political or policy wise. But this is interesting because we still don't know a lot about this individual other than just the little that we've learned in recent days. There isn't a lot yet to even point to that there was a political motive. We don't know. But you know, the internet is running wild. People are assuming it's political.
As they will.
As you know, and so That's the unfortunate of it all. So I do think you're right. I think it'll never die down. It makes me think, like, if the Kennedy assassination had happened in today's environment, can you imagine?
And what makes this one so strange is I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't believe the Secret Service, that there's some grand conspiracy for them to get Trump killed. I do think the Secret Service, like every other agency, can have lapses and be completely caught off guard. Also looks like the Secret Service was farming a lot of this out to local police.
Yes.
Local police are not Secret Service. Secret Service is a very specific function. But, Brandon, I don't understand how this dude was on the building for over 3 minutes. He was identified with a gun by people at the rally for over 90 seconds until the first shot went off.
And
police officer climbed the building, saw him, climbed back down, and said, "What should I do?"
Well, yeah, so I read the local police officer was confronted by him, saw the gun, and just immediately retreated, which is crazy to me. But it also evoked Uvalde. Or we've seen other incidents where police have been met with somebody with firearms, and instead of reacting, they retreat. I've read entire articles about that in terms of that being an issue. But I think there's also, like you said, jurisdictional issues at play. Because from what I've read, that this building was just outside the 200-foot perimeter. So technically it fell under the local law enforcement purview.
Yeah, I've heard that.
But even if that's true, why would you not take charge and say, okay, Why would I mean?
I'm sorry, we're the Secret Service. We're in backwater town, Pennsylvania. It is our responsibility, 100%, to make sure Trump is safe.
Right, and I don't like the conspiracy theories and all that. Like, I don't buy any of that, for instance. But I think people also need to remember, and I've reminded some people about this, because I think we like that our agencies like the Secret Service are perfect and they're highly trained and they're formal. But the Secret Service has had a series of scandals in the last decade or so. Like, there's been a lot of controversy. The heads of the Secret Service have been replaced multiple times in the last decade. I remember during the Obama years when, during official visits to Colombia, there was a scandal with the Secret Service agents that were involved in drugs and prostitution.
Wasn't that in Central America?
They South went
down
Colombia.
Yeah, they went down there and all partied. And,
yep.
Yeah, just got messed up. And
they. Do you know how that was actually found out, by the way?
Prostitutes.
They stiffed a prostitute. They didn't want to pay her. These Secret Service men refused to pay the prostitute, so she went public, and then it all came out, and then there was a whole thing about it. So.
Every professional politician knows. You always pay the help. You always pay the prostitute. Come on. That's an easy way to get caught.
And then, I don't know if you remember this, Craig, but again, it's interesting because I feel like in today's day and age, we're inundated with so much that people's memories are very short term. But I remember in 2014, there was a perpetrator that was trying to get at President Obama that scaled the White House fence and made it all the way to the East Room before he was shot at and apprehended by Secret Service. And that was a huge scandal at the time, because I remember, and it was Republicans in charge of Congress, but to their credit, they're like, I can't believe this happened. This guy almost made it all the way to the East Room of the White House. So he did make it to the East Room. He was just outside. And so they were going to haul Secret Service head up to Capitol Hill for an explanation and do an investigation. And I never did remember finding out, like, why or how that happened, that the person was able to make it that far before the Secret Service acted. But there's been several stories like this in the past, 10 or so years. It's easy to forget them. So clearly there's a problem there. The current head of the Secret Service replaced the person who was in charge on January 6th because there was controversy then. Because if you recall, Mike Pence wasn't comfortable getting into a motorcade with a Secret Service agent at the time. So,
and Trump had a battle with the Secret Service too that day, didn't he?
He did, in the car, about going to the rally or not going to the rally. There was also the thought that they weren't as aggressive enough and trying to deter him. Suffice it to say, there's been a long history of controversy with the Secret Service, and there's never really been, I think, any like full investigation by Congress and really any resolution to, okay, have you stamped out all these issues? Have you retooled your training?
Well, at least now we have a catch-all an explanation for all of this, Brandon. It's obviously DEI. There were two women agents there, and the head of the Secret Service is a woman. Obviously, these people are severely unqualified, and they're only there because of some government DEI program.
I saw that. That's making the rounds on the MAGA ride, which I assumed was only a matter of time.
DEI has just become a catchphrase now.
Everything,
to explain a poor performance from a jetliner's tires popping out to Trump getting almost shot in the head. DEI has infected us everywhere, Brandon.
It's insane. Well, did you see, speaking of the misinformation, there was a photo floating around of that moment where the Secret Service were crouched over Trump just after, where they were smiling, which turned out to be completely fabricated. Because the original photo, they're not smiling. They look serious. But somebody was spreading that, like, look, it's an inside job. They're smiling. Why are they smiling when the president was just shot? Well, somebody messed with that photo. That's not the real photo. Oh, my gosh.
Let's get to the myth-making that's being built around this. And part of it is myth-making in politics is always there. So it doesn't – I don't get that upset by what's been said or going on or how Trump is utilizing this now to be part of his brand and how he's going to utilize this going forward.
Now, it fits within his character. I mean, he's always about branding and mythologizing.
You get to make whatever commercials you want is my phrase.
But that photo, he could not have like engineered more perfectly with him like fist bumping.
That's that lizard brain.
Fight, the American flag right behind him. I mean,
he has enough instincts to know every camera and every eyeball in the world is on him. Do something that helps your cause.
Oh, that was clear like in the video because he forces his head up. Like, he like forces himself up because he wanted that.
Remember
viral
what the
moment.
First thing Trump says to the Secret Service when they come to him on the ground? What's the first thing he says?
About his shoes.
And why is he so concerned about his shoes?
I actually don't know.
Because he has a 2-inch lift in each shoe. That's why his shoes fell off so quickly.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, he was very concerned to make sure I get my shoes so nobody sees the lifts that I put in my shoes. This is this is Trump's psychosis and his neurotic personality all coming into play to produce a moment that is very unique to Trump and that no other politician could probably pull off.
No.
Because no other politician has the instincts now of, this is actually something I could use. Let me fist pump. Let me turn this into what's going to be the centerpiece of my PR campaign.
And most
going
would not
forward.
Think to do so in the moment. You're talking about like mere seconds after almost being killed. Like that's just not going to enter into the lexicon of most people. But for Trump, it will, and it absolutely made sense. Because I saw that on TV. I'm like, oh my gosh, I totally see what he's doing here. Like, I mean, it's so like obvious.
So the general consensus of the people I was sitting with when we watched all of this at a wedding reception, multiple people at the same time said, well, Trump's won. This is over. When he was fist pumping, getting into the Secret Service Escalade, multiple people were like, well, we can just have the election today if you want. This is done. Trump's winning. I don't think you buy that. But tell me why I shouldn't buy that.
Well, so if the election were tomorrow or a week from now, I would totally buy that. And I wouldn't diverge from you at all on that. The only reason I say I don't buy that right now is because we have 3.5 months left. And I feel like this has already been a crazy year. And it feels like week to week, like just stuff continues to happen. So I don't assume that there won't be some other crazy outside event or some type of international event that would, you know, shake up the race. I just feel like it's too soon to say like 100% certainty the race is over today. So that's part of the calculus. I'm also curious to see, you know, in terms of like what this does overall, as far as the polling. Biden was already on a downward slide.
Yeah.
That hasn't been helped. I don't know when or where the bottom has fallen off there, if we're going to continue to see slippage bleeding into outer ring states that should it be swing states like Virginia, like Colorado.
I think we already have. New Mexico, Virginia, Massachusetts, those are all in play right now.
I do think, and again, I've had conversations with a few friends about this, including friends that are Democrats who are just like frustrated with everything, but said, you know, the one thing that could shake this up is if the Democrats would stage an intervention, completely replace Biden at the ticket, like come up with something innovative, put something forward.
What does that intervention look like? Because there's no forcing him out. Right.
Need to be somebody like Pelosi, Obama, congressional leaders coming together.
But at the end of the day, he has to agree to it.
He would have to agree to it. Yeah. I mean, they can't force him out.
There is no forcing his hand if he don't want it forced.
But there also hasn't been, I think, pressure at the highest level other than like subtle, you know, television appearances by people like Pelosi saying, oh, he needs to think about this some more.
Let me ask it this way. Can Trump... Let me ask it the other way. Can Biden win? Do you agree that Biden has to have help to win this race?
Oh, Trump absolutely.
Trump has to step on it for him to win.
Absolutely.
Okay. So if Trump basically just did nothing for the next 3.5 months, he wins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think if he, you know, he was very toned down when Biden was collapsing over the last couple of weeks up until the shooting. Like if he remained that Trump or, you know, his tone slightly changed, like I think it's completely over. You know, I think the question is, does he go back?
Just make sure you just said that this race is over. If Trump just can hold it together for 3 months, this race is done.
If he doesn't go back to bombast and just unfiltered, you know, I think that's the key. That's the question, whether or not he's able to do that.
So the question I have with Trump at this, Trump was, let's make sure we're all clear. Trump was winning before this happened. Trump had a lead in every swing state, and he was up 3 or 4 in the national polls. He was sitting, coming off of Biden's debate performance, he was sitting in an absolute commanding position from a math and electoral perspective.
Yeah.
And all this did was boost the myth of Donald Trump. Because Trump's myth and his appeal is about strength. This event was so on brand for him. Brandon, we can't say that, well, Trump is as equally as bad as Biden, because that's not true. if I'm not going to believe my lying eyes, what I saw in that debate, then I can't believe my, then I'm not going to diss them and not believe them what I saw with Trump.
From an age perspective, right?
Well, just from a, he got shot and he got back up perspective.
Well, yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think in terms of like strength versus weakness.
He's not this babbling buffoon we all want to make him out to be. He's trying to strap his mental and physical status to Biden's. That ended at the, at this assassination attempt, didn't it? I mean, did you see an infirmed man?
No, I didn't. Yeah.
What would have that been? Would have been Biden? So one core big piece is kicked out. This, well, Trump is in cognitive decline and physical decline, and he can't do the job. He's as bad as Biden. That's gone. We can't say that anymore. That's one of the things that happened here.
Trump gives us further evidence on the cognitive side, if he devolves at another rally to say anything unintelligible or confuses somebody, which he's had in the past, something crazy.
I think we're past that a little bit because the comparison to Biden is where I'm at. There's nothing that he can do that offsets what he did Saturday after being shot and how poor Biden is. It just, I don't think that ground exists.
Yeah.
It just, he can't do it. Mm-hmm. So we get through the shooting, we get through the news cycle. So let's talk about the news cycle a little bit. Brandon, who is to blame for Trump getting shot?
I mean, I would argue, the message coming out of that is that it's the incendiary comments and what people have said. There isn't anything yet to suggest that the person who did this was motivated specifically by, specific rhetoric, whether that be from Biden or from Democrats. The problem I have with that is that I think it's, how do you say that Trump is a threat to democracy without saying he's a threat to democracy?
Do you have to morph his face with Hitler's together, like I think it was Newsweek did, and put that on a magazine saying American fascist? Would that be a way not to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously, something you would do.
But constantly referring to him as Hitler, would that be something we could knock off?
Yeah, I think so too. I think there's things that can be done and should be done. But also, I think it's very disingenuous to hear this stifling of any and all criticism of Trump from the right when they have been hyperbolic now for months in their rhetoric. I mean, they have a gubernatorial candidate in North Carolina on camera just weeks ago who advocated for direct killing of political opponents.
But isn't there like a 72-hour grace period when you get your ear blown off in an assassination attempt? We can't lay off the gas for 1 second. Not one segment of MSNBC or CNN. We can't try to humanize somebody. We immediately shift to justifying why all of this rhetoric on both sides is okay because Trump's Hitler. We're right back to where we started, I guess.
Well, I don't think in the media environment that we're in, like, I think it's a quaint notion to expect that you would stop. There's no defining event that would stop that. I mean, if
so, Trump almost coming within a millimeter of getting the back of his head blown off. That's not a stopping moment.
What I'm saying is, like, online, in terms of what people say and do online, I mean, you're not going to be able to control or do that. I mean, as far as the mainstream media goes, I mean, I think that there's been a grace period. I haven't seen that there's been just this return to incendiary comment. But I think at some point, like, that has to also level off, and you have to be able to wage a political campaign where you contrast with your opponent why you're different and why, you know, his ideas are bad and his policies would be bad for the country. You can't also go in, you know, with your hands tied behind your back if your opponent is going to be aggressively going after you and your governance of the country, and you're afraid to do so because there was an assassination attempt on his life. I think it's a very tricky situation, but I think it's also a situation where there also has to be some pragmatism. I think there's a lot to be said for toning down the rhetoric in terms of the imagery you say, how you use that imagery, you know, probably talking about your opponent being in a bullseye is not something you should say or do anymore.
I mean, I asked that series of questions because I'm getting to Biden's interview with Lester Holt, where Lester Holt asked him, sir, is it time to turn the temperature down? And Biden went through and listed every single person or entity or party that he felt needed to have a little talk with themselves. You know, is this really how I want to present this? Who was the one person he left out of that? Himself. At no point did the president ever look at the camera and say to the American people, I want to say that, yes, I've had a part in this and so have the Democrats. And it's time for all of us, including myself, to take a different tack. How impactful could that have been? He didn't. All he did was argue with Lester Holtz and appear to get mad when Holtz pressed him on, and you haven't done any of this? You take no blame, no responsibility? Nope, Biden took none of it. He immediately swung back to, and why won't you talk about Trump? So, once again, Biden has an opportunity. Biden had the first opportunity to unify. And he just completely missed it. And he missed it because he can never take any recognition that we have, the Democrats, we have a part in this. And that's just not something we're going to. We feel as if we say that, we've somehow, again, validated Trump. And it keeps us from saying simple, basic truths that when we don't say them, we appear dumb and hypocritical to the public.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that to a degree. I do think, but if unifying just means like stopping all the criticism you do, you know, holding back from criticizing your opponent while the other side can continue to go wild, unrestrained, unpoliced. What type of unity is that? Or at the, you know, I think at the cost of, free speech or being able to lay out a case. I think that's where it gets difficult and dicey. Where do you draw that line? What, you know, there are going to be elements on the right that think any criticism of Trump or saying he's dangerous to democracy or poses a threat to democracy is over the line. That's a question. Where do we fill it out over the next couple of weeks?
I just can't believe the Democrats have never gravitated to. You want to know how to show everybody what a child and a baby Trump is? You act like an adult. And we've just never done that around Trump. As Trump has acted like a toddler and a child and an imbecile, we've been there right along by him. We've never, ever tried to separate ourselves from Trump and Trump's antics. We've never come out and said, don't care. He can do whatever he wants to do. Can't control him. If you're on that team, I wish you luck. But we're going to manage our business. And we're going to try to manage our business so good, people look over here at us and say, that looks a lot better than what we got going on over here. All we've done is concentrated on Trump's rhetoric, his actions, his imbecile behavior. And we've never, where we are guilty in this, Brandon, I believe, is we've saddled right up next against Trump. We've never tried to put any distance between us and him. He calls us a name, we call him a name. He calls us something, we call him Hitler. And we've never tried to say, you're a child, and we don't care. That's not us. We're better than that. We run our business a different way. The time is, you can't do that.
I think there's a difference. I mean, you don't see a lot of like elected Democrats calling Trump Hitler or framing it in that mindset. Like you have elected Republicans calling Biden a communist and a fascist, and that we're not going to survive another term, or it's going to be civil war. The civil war talk, by the way, has gone on now for 4 years.
Yeah.
So I think there is a difference now. Are there party loyalists and activists online? Oh yeah, you can find multitudes of them on the left who are hyperbolic and use all kinds of language and stuff. But I think the example is set by those who govern. And so that's where I put kind of my laser-like focus, is those that are in elected office, how do they frame what they say about the opposition, and how do they set themselves apart? And I don't know. I we have these discussions all the time about how, like, we just move on too quickly and go back to business as usual. I just don't think, I think in today's age with social media, and I think that instigates people much more so than normally would be more taken aback and reserved in their language. I don't see a scenario where any type of detente lasts very long.
So neither party leader came out and said, this is partially my fault and we need to dial it down. So that means there will be no dialing down. There, this is not a unity moment. Nobody asked for unity except some people in the media who I think were thinking of a legacy moment where maybe that was appropriate. But Brandon, nobody is saying, let's put this back together. Nobody.
No, and I think that's part of the problem. I also have a real problem with President Trump's VP nominee, who immediately after the shooting blamed all Democrats for it. Like, that is also not the right tone to take.
Tweet to an audience of one, and apparently it worked.
The one reaction over the weekend is not really a reaction, but the one statement that I really took to that I appreciated was the Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, eulogizing he did of the firefighter who lost his life. Like, that is that, by the way, that is the type of monologue that Biden would not be able to give without stumbling over his words. The governor of Pennsylvania, who should be a front runner for the presidency, who in another world would be at this time, was able to deliver that beautifully, masterfully, in a way that, hey, we're all Americans. Like, this is where our political divisions stop at the door. And I don't, I just would like to see more of that. That was like a one-off. It felt like an anomaly because we don't see that type of.
So it feels like we're right back to Biden can't and Trump won't.
Yeah, I think that's a good encapsulation of it exactly. Biden can and Trump won't. I mean, that's what we're stuck with. And I think that's the angst that people feel like this is, we're at this point where we're stuck here again. We have no adults in the room. I keep talking to people even over the last several days, and over again the refrain is, why won't somebody do something? The somebody being the leaders, former leaders who something.
Who's the somebody? I always ask, why aren't they doing something? I always ask, who is the they that you expect to do something? Can you point to the person? Well, Barack Obama needs to do something. What does he need to do? I've heard the same thing from a lot of folks.
Yeah.
And people are frustrated that nobody's doing anything. Nobody understands the one person that can do something is the leader of the party who happens to be the president. That's it. There's nobody else that has any real input into this decision on if he stays or if he goes.
I do think that if we rewind 2 years ago now, I don't know if discussions happened or not, but 2 years ago would have been a really good time for people like Obama and Pelosi to lean in. Hey, are you running again? Yeah, I'm running again. Maybe let's rethink that. Maybe that's not something. Because at that point, we could have gauged that, first of all, he's super stubborn, that under any contingency scenario, he apparently is not going to step down because he thinks he alone can beat Trump, that I alone can fix him mentality, not dissimilar from Trump. So that is very off-putting, and it's a reminder, too, that we're in a situation because we have somebody who's very stubborn as an incumbent who I think is out of touch with reality quite a bit. It's out of touch with polling. I don't know how much of that is Biden's fault versus the team around him, which also keep him pretty closed off from everybody else. But I would have hoped, because I had that thought a couple years ago, again, thinking that Biden was going to serve one term and hand the baton off to somebody younger generationally, that there would have been discussions with head honchos in the party, former leaders that would have come forward and saying, okay, like, are we going to go through with a second campaign, or are we going to look at having like a succession plan? Like, I just, maybe that's naive to me to think that that would have happened 2 years in, but
I thought that would be standard 101, but apparently both of us are just ignorant to that doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. Like,
Brandon, how many hours of your life have you pissed away in corporate America working on some dumb shit?
Oh, gosh.
Emergency planning thing that you know is never going to happen, not going to work, and it's just a checkoff for some audit.
More times than I can count. All the time.
And not a damn thing.
We don't do that with the White House and with the leader of the free world? Yeah.
So we've covered two things that are working against the Democrats, specifically after Saturday. One is Trump's in masculine myth-making mode. That's his natural place.
Yep.
That's where the people see him.
Riding high.
He is right where he wants to be. The second is the Democrats don't know what their rhetoric should be. We've been going on threat to democracy still applies, but we just don't know how to spin it. And we know if we get this wrong, we're going to get cracked by the Republicans and other people as well. This is a sensitive time. We need to spend some time figuring out what this message is. The third thing is the media is in an absolute blender at this point. If the media is the ally of the Democratic Party, they are nowhere to be found here. They still can't get their shit together over should they be criticizing Biden over the debate or should they not be criticizing him over the debate. They can't figure out should they be calling Trump Hitler and a fascist? Should they not be calling him Hitler and a fascist? And in one of the absolute, what I think, most ironic moments of media stupidity that's ever happened, Morning Joe got pulled off the air Monday because the bosses at MSNBC did not trust them or their panel of experts not to say something that, in the words of the company, wouldn't damage their show or damage their brand. Brandon, what the fuck is that?
That struck me as pretty crazy and an overreaction, but I don't know. I don't watch them regularly. I see clips every now and then. I catch clips of them. So I don't know if there's a habit of them saying incendiary things or going off the rails compared to other shows on MSNBC.
I mean, they're all over the board and they say stupid stuff and they have guests on that say stupid stuff because they're supposed to say stupid stuff.
But you know,
that's why they're there.
When I thought of a host on MSNBC that used to get in trouble all the time for saying crazy things was Keith Olbermann. If you remember back in the day, I mean, he would just go way off. Yeah. On stuff, and
they're
that's
not
who
that, but they're pretty for today's
pretty out there.
They're pretty out there, but they pay those two $16 million a year. Brandon, if we work this both from, let's say you and I are the co presidents of MSNBC, and you come up and say, I think we should set them down for the day, and I agree with you. Well, later on, I call you and say, well, we're just firing them, right? I mean, we're not doing this. If we both agree that we don't trust our two core anchors on our main news show to cover the biggest news event of the last decade, what are we doing? Why are they here? What are they adding? This makes no sense to me. And then to have them come on the air today like two little brats and give a warning to management, you do that again and we're going to quit. Please, please do. Why are you here now? Anybody with any self-respect would have already quit. I mean, the media has been absolutely de-pantsed the last 3 weeks. First was when Biden, and now with this assassination attempt. The old media, the legacy media, the main, whatever you want to call them, are proven. They're just absolutely worthless. And there's really no reason to watch any network legacy news anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I still at times prefer getting hard news, you know, from some of the network news. You know, usually that's in the form of their websites more so than their live programming. But I do think it poses a lot of challenges for us as a society, because the idea that somehow if legacy news dies completely and we just become like siloed echo chambers on social media and different platforms and different influencers who are then, you know, broadcasting their news or their version of it. I don't know who that serves either. I think that presents a lot. I mean, we're already seeing that in terms of conspiracy theories that are out of control. We saw that happen during the pandemic with QAnon nonsense that really just kind of found fertile ground and grew. You can point to a lot of events that happened because of news on some of these platforms, like Pizzagate, when the guy went in to, you know, barely shoot Hillary Clinton, who he thought was there. So again, these are all one-offs, but I could see those becoming more normalized if we're in an environment where everybody just gets their news only from, you know, these influencers online, people that subscribe to their ideological views, and that's it. That seems to be the direction we're heading. And the problem too is there's no, you can argue that standards are lax with legacy media, which they are, but there's no standards when it comes to anybody who's on a platform. They can just broadcast or say whatever they want. They can put out a doctored photo of Secret Service agents, which they did this last weekend, and that can take off like wildfire before somebody like questions it and says, hey, this isn't accurate.
CNN is down to under 500,000 viewers in their primetime hours.
Yeah, I mean the viewership ridiculous. Of the debate was the only time they've even had that many viewers.
So we come out of this very difficult to understand assassination attempt on Trump. One of the things that I think makes it easier is the fact that this was just clearly a mentally deranged 20-year-old kid.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this was kind of a suicide by Secret Service, too.
That's what it sounds like. I mean, they still haven't found anything like overtly political in any of his stuff. He's one of those kids, it sounds like, was super smart but super deranged. We've seen that profile.
Super bullied.
Super bullied. So I was going to say, like, this is the profile we see in a lot of these mass murder, suicide, or perpetrators, right? Young kid, like 18 to 25, loner, bullied, you know, kind of odd, kind of, you know, keeps to himself, you know, and who wants to make a statement or do something. And I think people struggle. People always, I think we're conditioned because we have so many mass shootings now. Like, I mean, it's all the time. Like, it's become normalized. But every time there's a mass shooting, because we've had several where they've left behind manifestos or their motives clearly, we just assume or expect there's going to be a motive written down somewhere or recorded somewhere. That's not always the case. There's still plenty of instances where we never learn the motives of some of these people. Good example is the Las Vegas shooter. That guy, we still don't know what his motives were. He didn't write anything down. He didn't leave anything. Like, we have no motive at all when it comes to him. And that was the largest mass murder
shot
event.
50 people. It didn't say a word.
60. There were 60 casualties.
But,
yeah.
Like you said, nothing. Nothing over that.
Sniped him out from the top of the Mandalay Bay. Yeah.
So, Brendan, I want to take a few minutes and talk about the Republicans have done a very good job in those far right media echo chambers that you just talked about of talking about Democratic violence and that the Democrats are a bloodthirsty Democratic. They're a bloodthirsty, violent group that will do anything to put their hands on political power. And my evidence for that starts in 2020, starts with the CNN mostly peaceful riots, where they were burning cities down to the ground while people were saying this is just a protest. It's not only the billions of dollars of the property damage it damaged the Antifa and BLM and Democrats and leftists did in the summer of 2020. This assassination attempt is just a logical extension of that. Brandon, we're dealing with a very violent group with the Democrats. The 2020 riots prove that. They killed people. They burned things down. The idea that they've kept that pressure up and that they're as violent as they were 2 or 3 years ago, it's just a natural progression of what you saw on Saturday. You may not believe that, but that is going to get a ton of run in that new right-forming news echo chamber, whatever that is. That is one of the core pillars of that side of the argument's argument.
Well, and the fires and rioting in 2020, summer of 2020, have been used by the right for a long time now as a form of whataboutism to January 6th. You know, I would also put forward, and again, facts don't matter in these circumstances, but the BLM riots didn't have a political concession they were trying to exact in terms of going after the president or a party directly. You know, so that is a difference versus what we saw, for example, on January 6th. Again, two very different things.
True, but that's a hair to split to somebody who's just looking at the two. I think this all kind of snowballs into each other, and it shows how the Trump campaign is going to use this assassination attempt moving forward. The Democrats are out of control. They've been out of control for a very long time. They're really kind of feeling their power right now. The trans agenda has gone way too far. It's time to pump the brakes on all of it. If there's a party that needs their leash yanked a little bit, it's not the Republicans, it's the Democrats. That's the message they're going to come with. And I think that message is going to be fairly well received, again, to the limited number of people they're trying to get to vote for them.
That's a lot of threads to tie, though. And I guess my question, too, is like I can see them definitely linking the 2020 riots. But if you're linking the 2020 riots to what happened Saturday, what do you have in between there? Like, if you're trying to paint this picture of this, you know, stream of political violence, what else? What exists between those two?
Again, I'm not saying this to you as a rational adult political actor. This is targeted to mostly men under 30 who exist in those media spaces that we've talked about.
Well, and I think it does fit into a narrative because there has been this narrative that on the right, especially with young men that don't fit into any specific bucket or what they see as like a target constituency of the Democratic Party, that you're under siege, you know, your way of life is under threat. Yeah. We've seen that for a long time now, that if the Democrats get in power, the country's not going to be the same. So I can definitely see this fitting into that narrative where, you know, this is all part of an effort to minimize you and to marginalize you. And that's why we need Trump back, you know, because, you know, they don't care about you. And look at what lengths they went to show that.
And you've just really greased the runway nicely to get to the convention and J.D. Vance. I mean, J.D. Vance has been the story of the first day of the convention. Outside of Trump riding it like Caesar to the convention to all hail with the bandage on his ear. And then why? Why do they make that man sit for extended periods of time when a camera could be on him? Because he falls asleep as soon as he sits down because he's old.
Yeah.
So he had his hero's welcome. They sat there and listened to people talk and nodded and stuff and all of that. But really, last night was about the introduction of J.D. Vance.
That's right, on the stage.
What's your general thoughts on Mr. Vance?
Oh, I think J.D. Vance is a very scary, very dangerous individual, super intelligent, has a you know, Yale background, law degree, business background, pedigree. You know, he is somebody who is it ignorant or incapable, like we've seen with Trump, in terms of being able to exact the outcomes he wants. And J.D. Vance is somebody who knows better as well, who through 2016 was not only anti-Trump, but claimed that Trump could be America's Hitler. I mean, if you want to talk about hyperbolic language or being rhetoric that is too far, look at some of J.D. Vance's past statements on Trump. J.D. Vance changed course and did a 180 when he decided he wanted a Senate seat from Ohio. And he looked at the demographics that were changing in Ohio and said, well, my best bet is to not only run as a Republican, but run as Trump's choice in the primary, which is what he did. And if you look at the stuff he has said, I don't think the language that he uses and the way he talks about what he wants to do with government, it's not even subtle at all. I mean, it is in very stark terms that I think harken back to autocratic terms, you know, talking about, you know, comparing, you know, what Saddam Hussein did in Iraq and saying that's what we should do with the federal bureaucracy and replace, you know, every mid-level bureaucrat with, you know, somebody who's accountable only to us.
Yeah.
The de-bathification, he called it.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know what you're doing when you use that kind of term. I mean, you're referencing Saddam Hussein and you're referencing Iraq. And, you know, he has made plenty of other comments similar to that, not only incendiary, but very divisive in terms of how he sees. He's been a guest on Steve Bannon's podcast numerous times, talking about how this is like a war for the future of Western civilization. So that's where he's coming at. He's very much about grievance, very MAGA, but he is also very populist. He does not hew to traditional Republican economics, what you would call supply-side economics at all. He's differentiated himself in that he's put himself opposed to a lot of corporate initiatives, you know, has spoken out against those, has tried to fashion himself as somebody who's more pro-worker, which presents a threat to the Democrats just from that angle. So in terms of who you should be afraid of long term, he is somebody, because he is the future of MAGA. If MAGA survives beyond Trump, it'll be because of J.D. Vance, and it has a staying power. And I think lastly, J.D. Vance is the solution to the Mike Pence problem, meaning
absolutely.
Mike Pence would have do Trump's bidding. And J.D. Vance has said, absolutely, if that had been me there, I would not have certified the election.
I've been thinking of this analogy, and I think this is kind of clever, but I'm also going to butcher it, and it probably kind of sucks. Trump is the moon. He doesn't generate his own light. He can only reflect what other people are projecting. Trump is hemmed in by his own stupidity.
Yeah.
All he does is he looks at the landscape and reflects back to people what it is that makes them angry and uses that to move forward. J.D. Vance is the sun. J.D. Vance can generate his own light. J.D. Vance has an IQ of over 145. He has a law degree from Yale. He was a Marine who I believe saw combat in Afghanistan.
Yep.
He wrote Hillbilly Elegy, and he wrote that book. He didn't ghostwrite it. He wrote that book. So let's,
and he's only 39. He has a long life ahead of him.
So
yeah.
let's think
long
about what I just politics. Said. A dude who has a genius level IQ, who has a Yale level education, who has the life experience to write Hillbilly Elegy, and was a United States Marine. Also, too, he is going to be his job moving forward. Trump is going to take the next 3.5 months and build that myth. All he's going to talk about is, I didn't cry when I got shot. I fell down. I got back up. Fight, fight, fight. That's all he needs to do. J.D. Vance is saying, bring the rest to me. I got this. The Dems, they're not. I can run through this. He has spent the last 6 months doing interviews with CNN, Caitlin Collins, Dana Bash. He knows how to handle the liberal media. This is the sign that Trump gives two shits about anybody else except his base, is making no attempt to expand his base because the juice isn't worth the squeeze. After 8 years, everybody knows who he is. Could he gain some suburban women on the margins? Maybe, but it's not worth the time or money. And for every single voter he lost out of the suburbs, he's going to try to replace with a rural male voter.
That's exactly right.
And that's what J.D. Vance is going to do. J.D. Vance is a problem. And what he really represents is MAGA now has a champion moving forward. And J.D. Vance is going to intellectualize MAGA. I don't know how he's going to do it, but he's going to turn this into an actual political platform. If the goal was Trump was a bump and then he goes away, the picking of Vance, nah.
Yeah, J.D. Vance is the succession plan and the continuity of MAGA. I would also argue that if Trump is reelected and Project 2025 comes to fruition, it'll be J.D. Vance who's executing
Absolutely.
On that. He'll be the brains
He's the tactician.
Behind the execution of 2025.
Now, I thought he would pick Vivek Ramaswamy. Because Ramaswamy is just a more obnoxious version of Vance, right?
Pretty
because
much, yeah.
I thought Ramaswamy, because he could finally look at the Republican Party. Do you get it now? Do you understand? It's gone. Look at it. Look who's here standing. It's me and this dude that it's over. The question isn't, how's Lisa Murkowski going to get reelected? Nobody cares. Nobody cares what Susan Collins does.
Yeah.
Utah, Romney's not running. I own it. Lock, stock, barrel. It's mine. Whatever you thought the Republican Party was, it's not. It's this.
And that could not be more apparent when the convention opened, because at this convention, you did not have Trump's former VP, Mike Pence, there. Also uninvited was the only living former Republican president, George W. Bush. And also uninvited was the former Republican presidential standard bearer before Trump, Mitt Romney. So that paints a very telling photo of or picture of where the party is headed and the fact that this transformation is nearly complete at this point.
I mean, Trump is stupid, not dumb. Just like J.D. Vance, when he said, I want to get into politics, not only did he pick the party that he knew he could infiltrate, he picked the wing of the party that he knew was ascendant. He has been with Charlie Kirk, Steve Bannon, and Jack Posobiec from day one. He's only been a senator, what, 5, 6 months, 7 months?
Well, 2022 was when he was elected.
Right.
Yeah, a couple of years, yeah.
But what I'm saying is he has been on that side from day one. Day one.
Oh, absolutely.
And he knew that was the ascendant side of the party.
He made that decision when he decided he wanted to run for the Senate. That's when he pivoted and changed every core belief he had and decided this was the path.
And what truly got him the nomination was, hey, Trump, I'm an empty vessel. You just pour into me whatever you want. And just point me in a direction. J.D. Vance is basically saying, just wind me up and point me at whoever you want me to attack. And if you think J.D. Vance has any concern about debating Kamala Harris, that's just fantasy. That's just Joy Reid and Rachel Maddow jerking off on MSNBC, talking about how much high of caliber politician Kamala Harris is. That's just gaslighting and stupidity. J.D. Vance was a great pick. It's a great pick because it tears at my soul to admit this, Brandon. The Republicans have a plan, and the Republicans are working a plan. We're not, but the Republicans are.
To that end, I meant to mention this earlier, too, about how we had a discussion about how Biden and how the Democrats need to prosecute the case against Trump as a threat to democracy and how you do that and what language you use. But I think the other problem the Democrats have, which Biden is unable to do, was prosecute the case for himself.
Yeah.
Like, what would you do? What are your policies for the next, you know, 4 years? Like, there is no coherent campaign platform that people know and understand and can digest on the Democratic side. You know, with Trump, it's build the wall, it's stop the illegal immigrants.
Yeah. We know what Trump says.
Right. And so it's soundbite proof, right? Democrats don't have a soundbite proof platform.
That's a great
that
point.
You can go to the American people with.
I mean, the Republican Party's been reduced to one word, Trump. You don't need to know more than that.
It's very easy, yeah.
Brandon, you've got to pick somebody up at the airport, so we're going to get out here a little bit early tonight. Yeah. What's your final, final is not a good word. How does the assassination attempt help Trump? How does all of this translate politically over the next 3.5 months as it pertains to the presidential election?
I think it clearly cements the contrast between him and Biden that he is somebody who is strong. He has the strength. The age question, despite the fact he's 78, goes completely out the window and just doesn't have the relevance it once had. He's a survivor.
That's
you know,
a good one.
Not only can he take the bullets, you know, directly and physically, but he can also take the metaphorical political bullets. So people know he will fight not only for his life, but fight in the Oval Office for them. So, you know, there's long been this with his supporters who they've long said Trump fights for us. Now, they're not able to go into detail about how or where that translates into policy, but they now have this imagery that they could say like, oh, he'll definitely fight for us. Look how he...
Everything about him was validated in one act of violence.
So I don't see, again, absent some kind of crazy external event, you know, or Trump doing something crazy in the next couple of months, how Biden is able to change that narrative. There's nothing Biden can do on his own, let's say outside of something external to do that. And that's the problem with Biden. Like, he himself cannot do anything. He doesn't have the capability to. He is not able to communicate. Physically, there's nothing he can do to change how he appears relative to Trump. So you are then left in a position where you're dependent upon some type of outside event or for Trump to just seriously mess things up.
Yeah.
And that's not a good place to be in. And again, it's not a place Democrats would be in with any other nominee. I mean, you can look down the list of alternatives where, you know, Democrats would be riding high and they would be the ones leading at, you know,
absolutely,
since the beginning of the summer, and they're not
with
at that place.
Any other candidate.
With almost anybody
any
else.
Other candidate.
That's right.
I agree with everything you just said. That's almost our hour. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks for listening to 2 Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at 2meninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at 2meninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at 2meninthemiddle. We'll see you next week.